The Immortal Game, episode number 16, with special book completion Q&A.
The Immortal Game is a San Francisco Chronicle Book of the Year and is available in ebook and trade paperback wherever books are sold. In this podcast, it's read by author Mark Coggins. Hear more at patreon.com/markcoggins or author website markcoggins.com.
Chapter 29, End Game. Duckworth and I were already sitting down to a lunch of Big Macs and fries at the East Palo Alto McDonald's when Stockwell came up.
"Who the hell is that?"
he asked, gesturing at Duckworth. "He's my partner," I said. "We're starting a new business doing people's colors." "Seafoam green," said Duckworth. "That's a color that would work for you, Lieutenant. Much better than that tepid, uninspired brown you have on today." Stockwell elbowed his way onto the plastic bench next to me.
"Is that right? Well, I think you two would look great in dog dick pink. What do you have to say about that?"
Duckworth tittered. "Dicks and the color pink are topics I wouldn't care to broach with Mr. Duckworth here," I said. I asked him to join us because of all the help he's given me on the case. I felt I owed him. Stockwell eyed Duckworth suspiciously, working overtime to process my comment about dicks.
"Okay," he said finally. "I expect you'd only blab it to him later."
"Now you're learning. You want to order some lunch? I might even buy."
"No, my wife doesn't let me eat this crap, and I don't want to drag this out any longer than necessary. This isn't exactly a social occasion."
"And all this time I thought you liked me. All right, then. What do you have for us?"
"Well, first of all, you fucking broke two of Bishop's teeth off. Did you know that?"
I might have noticed a certain gap-tooth aspect to a smile when the San Mateo County Sheriff's deputies helped him into the car.
"Oh, very observant of you. He says you rammed a gun down his throat."
I took a big bite of my hamburger and munched on it thoughtfully. They are right about this sauce. It is special. Stockwell glared at me and then grabbed a couple of fries and popped them into his mouth. He chewed them like they were fighting back. "Ketchup?" asked Duckworth.
"Shut up."
"Enough about Bishop," I said. "He should be glad I didn't rip him apart with my bare hands. What did you find out about the people who are dead?"
"That you were right. The autopsy showed that both McCullough and Haystrup were HIV positive."
"So McCullough infected Haystrup, and when he found out he was positive, he killed himself," said Duckworth.
"Yeah, looks that way. We never did find a note, but it turns out he donated blood a couple of days before he died. They routinely screened donations for HIV, and when they got the results back from his, they called him and told him he was positive. The administrator at the blood bank said he took it very badly, said he fell to pieces right on the phone."
"Still," said Duckworth, "that's no reason to kill yourself. They can do a lot more with the virus than they used to." "For Haystrup, it wouldn't just be the health aspect," I said. "For a macho asshole like him, there would also be the stigma of having a disease that only gays and drug addicts are supposed to get. That and the fact that Terry McCullough had given it to him. He'd see it as a humiliating betrayal."
"You seem to have a keen insight into the macho asshole mentality," said Duckworth. "Wonder why?"
I looked over at Stockwell and watched him shovel in a handful of fries.
"Don't look at me," he said with his mouth full of masticated potato. "You brought him."
"Everybody makes mistakes. What about Bishop and Jody? Do they have it?"
"Bishop refuses to take a test, and there's no way we can force him. Nor can we subpoena his medical records. The law guarantees confidentiality. Jody does admit to being positive, however. It looks like she'll admit to a great deal more, too, in order to save her hide."
"But what about Nagel?" asked Duckworth. "He's the real mystery man. What's his connection to all this?"
Stockwell popped another fry into his mouth and smiled.
"Yes, he is the mysterious one, isn't he?"
Stockwell gave me a hard elbow to the ribs.
"We finally matched up that fingerprint from the picture in McCullough's apartment, the one you said didn't mean anything. Who do you think it belongs to?" Your mom? Fuck you. It belongs to Nagel, of course. He's the one who hit you from behind, and he's the one who killed Teller. There's almost no doubt of it.
Great, said Duckworth, but that still doesn't explain who he is.
Did you ever think that Bishop's last name was a little too cute? I mean, him being a whiz at chess and having a name like Bishop and all.
Yeah, I said. It did seem a little coincidental. It could have worked the other way around, though. He has the name and he decides he's going to try to live up to it.
Well, that's not the way it worked. The way it worked is his name was originally Nagel. Todd Nagel is his younger brother.
Aha, said Duckworth. I knew it all along. I'll be right back. Duckworth got up from the booth.
Where's he going?
Asked Stockwell and ate another fry. To get the color wheel, but back to Nagel. I guess that explains how he could afford the house in Daly City. Bishop must have been giving him money.
That's right. We got hold of the bank records, and there's a regular stream of checks from Bishop to Nagel. The phone records tie them together, too. Bishop had another unlisted number that Nagel regularly called. Not that it matters. The fingerprint and the fact they are brothers are more than enough.
All right, let's see if I can walk us through this. McCull is working for Bishop. She contracts AIDS, either by sharing needles or through sex. She infects Bishop. Bishop tumbles to it and fires her. Or maybe he doesn't even know about the AIDS at that point and he fires her for drug problems like Jody told me. Doesn't matter. In order to get back at him, McCullough steals the chess software and tries to erase all of his copies.
Probably, but Bishop had an offsite backup service to protect against earthquakes, etc. Even if she zapped every copy in the house, there's no way she could have got to that.
What I figured. So she takes the software and goes to Teller with it. He'd love to get his hands on it because he's trying to squeeze every dime he can out of his business, but he doesn't trust McCullough. Teller contacts Bishop and asks if she's legit. By now, Bishop knows about the AIDS if he didn't know before. He could just warn Teller off, but instead he cooks up a scheme to revenge himself on McCullough by framing her for Teller's murder. He co-opts Teller by promising legitimate rights to his software and then sets him up for the kill at McCullough's apartment. But how does he... Duckworth came back to the table with another Big Mac. Here you go, Lieutenant. I'd hate to see a big, strapping man like you go hungry. And I'd like to eat a few more of my own fries. Thank you very much. Stockwell looked down at the hamburger. I could tell he was beginning to get an idea about Duckworth, but hunger won out over homophobia.
What the hell, said Stockwell. My cholesterol is only 205. I've got a good 35 points before my heart seizes up.
The longest journey begins with the first step, I said. But here's what I want to know, and I've wanted to know it for a very long time. How did Teller get a key to McCullough's apartment? And don't give me that nutso theory about Teller having an affair with McCullough, because that just doesn't wash. A big glob of special sauce ran down Stockwell's chin. He wiped it with the back of his hand, then licked it off.
The landlady, said Stockwell. Bishop bribed her to give him a key. Bishop sent a copy on to Teller with an invite to meet him there. Nagel shows up instead and knocks you out, and then kills Teller with McCullough's gun. A gun, by the way, that was a gift from Bishop.
How'd you get all of that? I asked.
The landlady told us about the key when we explained to her exactly what conspiracy to commit murder was. Jody gave us most of the rest of it, although she wasn't there for the kill.
Duckworth pulled the straw out of his soft drink and waved it around frantically to get our attention. Droplets of Coke splattered Stockwell's shirt, and he swore sharply. Duckworth was oblivious. Time out, you two. All this is fine and good, but I'm having trouble with the motives. I can see how Bishop would want to get back at Terry, but would we really kill an innocent man to do it? And would Jody really go along, even if she was infected?
Teller was far from innocent as far as Bishop was concerned, I said. Bishop felt Teller had ripped off the user interface of one of his earlier games. Killing Teller to ensnare McCullough would be Bishop's idea of a masterstroke of revenge on both of them. Stockwell grunted.
And I can explain the Jody part if you quit waving your straw around like a fucking fairy wand.
Duckworth straightened his chair and set his shoulders. He passed the straw over Stockwell like he was doing an incantation. Said, "Turn to shit!" Stockwell sighed.
You guys really belong together. You know that? If you believe Jody, Bishop blackmailed her into helping. Her dad's a federal appellate court judge. She said Bishop threatened to tell Pops that she was HIV positive. The old guy was freaked enough over her lifestyle, and Jody couldn't bear him knowing the AIDS shit, too. By the way, she claims it wasn't only AIDS and the software theft that prompted Bishop to get revenge.
What else was there? I ask.
Get this. She said Bishop was in love with McCullough. She said the final straw for him was when he heard that Terry and Haystrip were seeing each other.
I thought that through while Stockwell finished his hamburger in two bites. And McCullough? I ask. How did she die?
The how of it is pretty straightforward. It's the why I'm not sure about. The autopsy report says she died from a heroin overdose, complicated by the presence of ketamine and alcohol in her system. Well and good. What I can't tell you is whether she did it on purpose or by accident or...
Duckworth jumped in. Or whether Bishop and Nagel killed her. I'll bet you anything that's what happened.
Stockwell shrugged and began a mopping up operation with a wad of napkins. It's possible. But Jody says no, and we can't find any evidence to tie Bishop or Nagel to the heroin in the K.
Did the SFPD interview any of the street people in the Tenderloin, I ask? Maybe somebody saw McCullough scoring the stuff.
You know the high regard in which I hold the San Francisco cops. They say they made the rounds and that no one saw her. But that don't mean squat when it comes right down to it.
No, I said. I suppose not. Anyway, my vote is accidental. There's not much point in Bishop engineering a frame for McCullough if he's going to turn right around and kill her. Might as well have done that in the first place. As far as her doing it on purpose, she wasn't the type. She was much tougher than Haystrip, for instance. As a matter of fact, I think she liked being HIV positive. I think she delighted in the idea of dominating men, humiliating them during sex, and ultimately killing them.
Sounds like just the kind of gal you want to take home to meet Mom and Dad, said Stockwell.
Yes, but think about it, said Duckworth. There's not a single person involved in this who you could honestly say was blameless or untainted. Not Teller? He willingly helped Bishop. Not Jody. She was in it, too. Haystrip was McCullough's pawn. Bishop and Nagel were obviously out. The landlady's out. Even Dale Pace is out. Every one of them is dirty in some way. I looked out the window at a blonde woman sitting in an idling car in the drive-up line. She was nobody I knew, but the blonde hair got me thinking. You're wrong about that, Chris, I said. There's one person who's clean. Margaret Teller.
Chapter 30. Lonely Night. I called her that afternoon. I guess I had some idea of asking her out, but when I inquired how she was doing, the conversation got away from me.
I'm fine, Mr. Reardon, she said. I mean, August, of course. It is very thoughtful of you to call. We buried Roland 2 days ago, and while I'm sure I will go through many more phases of grief, at least I am past the anger. At least I no longer blame everyone in the community for his death.
I said that was good.
Good? Yes, you could say that. However, the anger was a companion in many ways. It gave me strength to fight off loneliness and this dreadful feeling of an inevitable fate. So I will miss the companion, but as I said, I value the progress.
The line was silent while I fought for something to say. Margaret Teller let me off the hook. She said,
"Just today I was thinking back to the night of Roland's death. I realized I knew something bad had happened, even before the police had phoned. There was a kind of sign, a harbinger, I guess it's called. I was in the living room reading my book, and all of a sudden a picture crashed from the wall. No one had touched it for days, or even weeks, I'm sure, yet it simply fell from the wall. It was not a picture that Roland particularly cared for or admired, nor had I some unexpressed mental association of it to him. But when I thought back to the night, I remembered its falling filled me with anxiety."
She laughed awkwardly.
"I suppose you think that's silly. I suppose you think it was only a coincidence."
When I finally spoke, my voice cracked like a teenager's. "No, I don't think it's a coincidence. I think you went looking for it, after the fact. If it hadn't been the picture, you would have remembered a broken glass or a watch that stopped. Those kinds of things happen every day, even when there are no other events of significance. You went looking for a sign to reassure yourself that there's an underlying order to the world. But there is no fate, Margaret. There is no destiny. Einstein said that God does not play dice with the universe. He was right, but not in the way he meant. God doesn't play dice with the universe because the universe doesn't need him. The craps table is set up and running. Whether God put it there or not is besides the point. To this day, I still don't know what possessed me to say that. I knew this was not the way to win Margaret Teller's heart. There was a long pause. "We are very different, Mr. Reardon," she said finally. "I thought you liked different. I thought that was why you married Roland Teller." "Yes, and you see what it got me. I disagree with you about fate. I know what mine is now, and I see there is no purpose in fighting it. Brad Wilford asked me to marry him yesterday, and I consented. I belong with him and people like him." A beat went by. "I don't think you should call me anymore, Mr. Reardon." Later that afternoon, I went to the bank. With everything that had happened in the past week, I had never found time to cash Bishop's retainer check. I was too late. The cashier informed me that Bishop had stopped payment on it. I was determined that the case not be a total bust, so I drove out to the section of Kings Mountain Road where I lost my hubcap and got out of the car to hunt for it. After an hour of searching, I found it wedged under a thorn bush, half filled with brackish rainwater and drowned crickets. I tossed the crickets over my shoulder for luck and polished up the hubcap with my handkerchief. Squinting down at my reflection in the bright metal, I said, "You and Kezarensky." The end.
Hi, this is Mark again. I hope you enjoyed The Immortal Game. I thought a nice way to wrap up would be to answer some of the questions I saw posted on Twitter about the book or received through email. To help me with that, I've asked podcaster extraordinaire Seth Harwood, author of Jack Wakes Up and Young Junius, to come to the studio and do a little Q&A.
Hey, what's up? That's right. This is your boy, Seth Harwood, happy to be here with Mark, the showstopper Coggins, to talk about The Immortal Game. I hope you've been loving the story like I have. And I've got some questions for Mark. Hope you're ready for them. Mark, you ready?
I'm ready, man. Fire away.
Okay. First, how did you come to write the book?
Well, The Immortal Game started out as a short story for a trade paperback quarterly called The New Black Mask. August Reardon's first appearance in print had been in another story for The New Black Mask called There's No Such Thing as Private Eyes, and I'd written The Immortal Game as a follow-up, but unfortunately the publication folded before the story made it into print. This was in the mid-80s. I put the short story in a drawer for about 10 years, and when I found the time to write again seriously around 96 or 97, I pulled it out and used it as the basis of the novel. Of course, it was much expanded from the original story.
How did you choose the name August?
I knew I wanted the last name of the character to be Reardon as a sort of homage to a character in Raymond Chandler's Farewell, My Lovely. For the same reason, I also knew that I wanted the first name to start with A. I finally picked August because I thought it was somewhat unusual, and I kind of liked the ring of it.
What about his character? Bass-playing, wisecracking PI. How did he come to you, and how would you describe his narrative voice?
Well, he's intended to be a throwback to Golden Age detectives. In fact, as the title of that first short story, There's No Such Thing as Private Eyes, suggests, the idea behind this story is that someone like Reardon couldn't really exist in today's world. Everything about Reardon flows from the idea that he's somewhat of an anachronism. The place he lives, the car he drives, his interest in jazz and antique stereo equipment, and his reluctance to come to grips with computers and high technology. I would say his narrative voice is the embodiment of his worldview. Jaded, cynical, and maybe tinged with a bit of hard-bitten humor. He doesn't care what others think of him, and he makes the quips and fires off the comeback lines you think of 30 minutes too late, or are too polite or reserved to actually vocalize.
Oh yeah, right. That's what I think about Jack Palms, too. You know, I fell for this guy. I felt for Reardon when his wife, I mean his bass, was so brutally taken from him. It seems like he would have totally gone apeshit, sugar in the pants, when it is destroyed in front of his eyes. Anything you want to say about that?
Yeah, a number of musicians have told me they found the scene where Reardon loses his bass to be particularly troubling. In fact, I was contacted by a real jazz bass playing private investigator who was convinced that I had bass Reardon on him. What made it really eerie was this guy had actually played gigs in several of the clubs I mentioned in the book, and his firm had been employed, unbeknownst to me, by a high-tech company where I once worked. But more to the point, the private investigator's big criticism of the book was that he felt Reardon would have reacted much more strongly to having his bass destroyed. He really wanted Reardon to go after Haystrip and Pace with a vengeance.
Where does his interest in jazz come from?
As I suggested earlier, Reardon's interest in jazz stems from the idea he belongs to a different era. For the most part, the style of jazz that Reardon likes to play and listen to comes from the 30s, 40s, and 50s. I'm not a musician myself, so this is one of the most difficult aspects of the book to pull off. However, I had a lot of help from a friend of mine named Larry Berger, who is a real expert in 1930s and 1940s jazz. Larry knows a lot of famous jazz musicians, most notably jazz saxophonist Benny Carter, who unfortunately passed away a few years ago, and he has assisted in the studio on several of Carter's records. Larry also helped with Reardon's antique hi-fi equipment, particularly with the description of the monster Altec Lansing speakers Reardon has in his living room. And to top it off, the photo I used to illustrate chapter 15 and the first and ebook editions of the novel is of Larry's wrist handcuffed to the speaker handle.
You seem to incorporate a lot of computery things, lots of references to technology and the Silicon Valley. Why is that?
My day job is in computers and software, so I'm leveraging the knowledge I picked up from working in the industry. However, Reardon himself is quite a technophobe. Part of the tension in the books comes from having him deal with technology that he would not use or be comfortable with.
One thing that definitely comes through in the novel is your love of San Francisco. Do you think of the city as a character in the novel?
I've been in writing groups where the question of whether a locale or a city can be a character in a book has provoked some very heated exchanges. I understand the perspective of those who say a city can't be a character. Cities don't have motives, make choices, engage in interior monologues, all the obvious things that define a character. That said, one of the reasons that I admire the work of Chandler and Hammett so much is the way they portrayed L.A. and San Francisco. When you read Chandler in particular, you really feel like you understand what it was like to live in Southern California in the 30s and 40s. He left behind a record of the city that photographs from the period, or even films, simply don't convey. In writing The Immortal Game, I set out to provide as realistic a picture of life in contemporary San Francisco as I could. In fact, readers of early drafts of the book often redlined sections where they felt I'd gotten carried away with descriptions of the city and the people in it. I took some of those suggestions, but if I erred, I always erred on the side of retaining details about San Francisco rather than omitting them. I guess the end result is that San Francisco, if not a character, is a well-painted backdrop or setting in which the characters of the books interact. I suppose a comparison with stage plays wouldn't be too far off. Some plays are done with little or no props and very Spartan sets. Others are done with sets that mimic real life as much as possible. It's the choice of the director, or the writer in my case, to select the approach that serves the story best.
I've seen a couple of comments on Twitter, and I've got to ask, was it really necessary to have the scene where Reardon plays the S&M tape near the end of the book?
I've gotten asked that several times. An old friend of mine, in fact she was the model for Nurse Penny Waller in the book, said that she, quote, wanted to take a spoon and remove the part of her brain where that memory was stored after reading it. But I still think it is necessary. Although Reardon doesn't express it to the reader at the time, that is the moment when he tumbles to the idea that McCullough has infected Bishop with HIV. Their sex is so blatantly unsafe.
What are some of the best ways that fans can show their appreciation for the podcast? I mean, other than going over to Amazon and buying copies of the ebook or trade paperback.
Well, you can certainly snag an ebook or trade paperback copy of the novel or any of the other August Reardon novels from Amazon. I'd also very much appreciate it if you went to Amazon, Goodreads, or Patio Books and gave The Immortal Game a 5-star review.
What's next from Mark Coggins?
I'll be podcasting another Reardon novel, Candy from Strangers. Reardon is hired by Stockwell's wife to find their missing daughter. You know you gotta listen to that.
Thanks for coming on here to talk about the book, Mark. I know I've really enjoyed it, and the fans have too.
Great to be talking with you, man.
You have been listening to The Immortal Game, a San Francisco Chronicle book of the year. You can find it in ebook and trade paperback wherever books are sold. In this podcast, it's read by author Mark Coggins. Hear more at patreon.com/markcoggins or author website markcoggins.com.